Podcast presents Session 16, Mormon Women and the LDS Bloggernacle, a panel discussion with Jana, Dora, Brooke Will, and Caroline.
This is session number 16, Mormon Women and the LDS Bloggernacle. And what I'm going to do is read just a little bit from the abstract. Well, actually, I won't read from the abstract. What we're going to do, we have a group of female panelists up here who are all bloggers, and we're going to talk about blogs today. Don't forget the regular rigmarole, turn off your cell phones, all that kind of stuff. We are going to have a pretty casual session today, so feel free to get comfortable, and I hope it'll be very interactive and fun for you. I feel like after a long day of sunstone, it's fun to have a casual session at the end. If my hair was long and up in a bun, I would pull it down now, and we would be pulling our hair down and relaxing, and I like that there's some people eating and making themselves really comfortable out there right now, because that's the kind of session that we're going to have. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. First of all, let me introduce a few of the people who are sitting, or all of the people who are sitting up here with me. And we are in the program using our blog names. It's kind of like a handle, like a CB handle or something. It's what we're known as in cyberspace. We're not afraid to use our real names, and we might be jumping back and forth because I'm not used to calling them these folks their blog names in person. So I'll start with myself. On the blogs, I go by two different names. Sometimes I'm Jana, which is my true first name. Sometimes I go by Pilgrim Girl because that's the name of my personal blog, and so that's the kind of cyber identity that I have. Just to introduce myself briefly, I'll read what's in the program. I live in Southern California with my spouse, my two kids, two cats, and 2,000 books. And then it tells the URL for my solo blog. All right, so sitting down here is Dora. She's a native Angeleno. She works as a pediatric ICU nurse and spends the rest of her time passionately involved in Lindy and blues dancing, literature, traveling, and trying new hobbies. Next is Brooke Will, who lives in Irvine, is a poet and mother of two boys and the wife of John. And her poetry can be found on her blog, limedivine.blogspot.com. Sitting next to me is Caroline, who's a high school Latin teacher with two master's degrees and is working on a third in library science. She's the mother of two rescued pugs and is expecting her first baby this summer. Isn't that fun? Okay, so I just need a show of hands from you. How many of you have ever seen a blog before? Okay, how many of you have not ever seen a blog before? Okay, so I'll start off talking to you, the one person in the audience who's never seen a blog. No, it's a helpful thing for people on the tape as well. We'll introduce blogs. And I'm not going to give an incredibly technical definition of a blog like you might get from someone who is a computer geek, which I'm not. But basically, a blog is a kind of, it's an online journal format, and it's different from a website in that a blog has a format where it's updated on a regular basis, and so you tend to have like a date and then an entry underneath, a date and an entry underneath. And I'm going to show you a few blogs here. Got to remember how all this technology is going to work for me. Okay, so this is not the blog I'm going to show you first. What I'm going to show you first, there are blogging superstars, and this is a blogging superstar who calls herself, or her blog is called Deuce.com. Interestingly enough, she is a former Mormon and talks a lot about Mormonism on her blog. She gets millions of hits per week. Huge blog. Very, very funny, very irreverent kind of blogger. So there's all kinds of blogs out there. Another one that I enjoy, this is Jen Gray, and she's a, I can't scroll down, unfortunately, very well on this. She's a, what we call a photo blogger. So each day she posts a photo with a few things talking about her photos. So there's some blogs are just text, some are photos, some are recipes, some are very political. Here's another blog superstar. Her name is Maggie Mason, a.k.a. Mighty Girl. She blogs about all kinds of interesting things. Here she's got a post about going to see the Dalai Lama. There are book blogs. This one, Book Girl's Nightstand, is kind of a fun book blog if you like to read. You can find blogs on almost any topic. So just to introduce you a little bit to it, I can show you my... There's my blog talking about being naked, which I didn't really intend to show you. But it does speak to sort of the intimacy of this format. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Okay, so I'm assuming a lot of you are very familiar with blogs. I don't want to bore you with all these details, but some of you who aren't might ask, and these are common questions, how do I get on a blog? Well, you just type in the address into your bar in your browser. There's no magical passwords or anything really to get on blogs. It doesn't cost money to read a blog, typically. There might be some out there that cost money. I don't know anything about that. But most blogs are free. The whole point is to have a public forum. And a blog is not just something you read, but it's something you interact with. So blogs tend to have spaces for you to leave comments, and there tends to be a dialogue. So if you look at this kind of post that I have here, it's a recipe. I don't have any comments. But if you wanted to leave a comment, you could click on here, and there's a space for you to leave a comment if you wanted to talk about that recipe that I posted there. Okay, so that gives us a general sense of how they work. Do I have any questions so far? Have I lost anyone? Okay.
Do you write it knowing that it's going to be read? I mean, what is your...
And I'm going to talk a lot about why in just a minute, so we'll get to that, because I think that's an incredibly curious question. Like, why do I want to post recipes or talk about being naked on the web? That's kind of strange. Okay. And that was actually the next question I had, or why do I blog? And I'm going to tell you more later, so you just read my mind. Okay. So what I wanted to do was just basically introduce you to this genre. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Caroline right now, who's going to introduce you to something called the Bloggernacle and how she encountered the Bloggernacle. The Bloggernacle is a kind of term that's used to refer to the collective group of blogs that are Mormon in some way. Sometimes there are Mormons writing them, writing like solo blogs about their lives, and they might talk about their Mormonism and their identity. Sometimes it's specifically Mormon topics, a group of people who are posting on Mormon history, that kind of thing. So anyways, Caroline's going to talk about Mormon blogs in particular, and then each person in our panel is going to read a little bit about some things that they've written on the internet and talk about why they blog or why they've gotten involved in this medium. And do go ahead and jump in with questions at any time.
Hi, I'm Caroline. As Janice said, I'll be talking a little bit about the Bloggernacle, specifically about the female Bloggernacle, because that's what I'm most interested in. As Jana pointed out, the Bloggernacle is a group of Mormon-themed blogs, and depending on who's counting, you could say that there are between 60 and 200 of these. And for the most part, I would consider them heavily male. From looking at blogs in the Bloggernacle, I would say that only about 20% I would consider female blogs. But I do think that female blogs are on the rise. These female blogs range from pretty mainstream to actually quite edgy, with feminist Mormon housewives probably being the edgiest big one that I know of. And Jen, if you could show a few of these ones. I wanted to take you through some of the most popular or the ones that are most well established of the female blogs, female Mormon blogs. Maybe one of the ones that has been around for a long time is Mormon Mommy Wars.
Okay, so the links are on the side.
They're on the Exponent site.
Oh, went to the wrong site. Sorry.
And Mormon Mommy Wars, I think it's been around for a while. Seems pretty mainstream, pretty traditional to me. And it's well established, and as you can see from the title, it's going to be about mothering for the most part, in stay-at-home moms who are dealing with their kids. Another one that's been around for a while and that is pretty well established is Conversation. Conversation.
Sorry.
That's okay. I would lump this in with Mormon Mommy Wars in terms of its edginess. Pretty traditional, pretty mainstream, but some very thoughtful posts. Also, going down, so I'm starting out with the ones that I consider more traditional, and then I'm going to the ones that I consider more edgy. One of the newer things is Tales from the Crib. This is also a Mormon Mommy kind of blog, but this one made a big splash, I think, about 6 months ago or so, because it came in with 18 posters. Most group blogs don't have quite that many posters, so it kind of made a big splash, and it's rising in popularity, I think. We have one of the most new female Mormon blogs that's come in is A Prayer of Faith. And this one is a little bit harder to categorize. Some of the posters seem pretty edgy and outspoken. Others, not so much, pretty traditional. And so that one I'm still kind of looking to see what's going to happen with this one. And then going to what I consider more edgy female blogs, we've got the Exponent 2, and that's what we're all involved with. So you can show the Exponent 2. And this one addresses issues and issues of women in the church, but it also does focus a lot on simply personal experience and reflection. So not everything is going to be critical of the church or even church-related, but pretty reflective also. And finally, we have the giant of the female bloggernacle, and that's Feminist Mormon Housewives. If you want to show that.
Yeah. Why did I just lose that? Oh, there it is.
This is huge. It's huge and gigantic, and it's the edgiest, I would say. It's the most willing to take risks out of all the female Mormon blogs that I know of. It's the broadest in terms of its range of commenters, going from the active to the not active, and it's dynamic. I would say it's the funniest. It's got the biggest readership, and this is the blog that gets cited in news articles. I think the New York Times has talked about it before, and I've even seen it referenced on like TV news programs. I think it's because the title is catchy and they think it's funny, Feminist Mormon Housewives, that it often gets referenced in these big news articles. So that was just a quick run through some of the things, some of the more important blogs I saw in the female bloggernacle. Now I want to talk a little bit about the Exponent 2 blog and how we got started. As I said before, we're all from the Exponent 2 blog, which we launched about 3 or 4 months ago in January. It all started when Jana loaned me a stack of her mother's Exponent 2 magazines, about 30 years worth of them. And as most of you know, the Exponent 2 publication came out in the 1970s, and it was developed by a group of women in Boston who were trying to reconcile their ideas of feminism with their faith in the Mormon Church. I looked through these issues, and I was really hooked, particularly by the earlier ones, which I thought were fiery and interesting. We became involved in the Exponent 2 organization because we guest edited the Southern California edition, which came out last summer. And we started thinking of other ways that we could help this organization because we were afraid it's on its last legs. It had an erratic publication schedule. We thought that its content was getting watered down. We thought that it was in imminent danger of dying soon. And we became convinced that the only way this thing was going to survive was if it got a major web presence. And that's when we started to develop the idea of the blog. And thanks to John Remy, who helped us figure this out, Jana's husband over there, we got this thing up and going. We presented it to the board. Some of the older members weren't so excited, but the younger members really saw this as something that could help the organization, and they're the ones that really pushed it through. Now, and to give you some idea of why we were so committed to helping this organization survive, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about its rich history. As many of you know, LDS women have this great history of women's publications. The Women's Exponent, which was the official publication of the Relief Society in the late 1800s to the early 20th century, was headed by Eliza R. Snow and Emmeline B. Wells, presidents of the Relief Society. And in the midst of upsurges regarding women's rights and suffrage, these Relief Society presidents were forthrightly calling out to their fellow women to throw off the mantle of servitude and claim their place besides men as their equals. And so, to give you a taste of the kinds of things that they were writing in the Women's Exponent, this was by Emmeline B. Wells. "Let all be awakened to the wrongs that must be righted, and the world will see that women's work is not simply to multiply and replenish, but to renovate, to restore, to cultivate and develop the highest instincts and aspirations. Let woman speak for herself. And it was that last part that really resonated for me. We are in an age when there is a dearth of authoritative female voices in the church speaking for themselves. No longer is there an official women's publication run by women. Now we content ourselves with the occasional conference talk by a woman, or the occasional Ensign article. This doesn't satisfy me. Relief Society lessons don't satisfy me with their exclusively male voice manuals. I needed more. I needed more conversation. I needed more grappling. I needed more issues. I needed more discussion of doctrine and policy and lived experience. The institutional church, from my perspective, no longer had forums where I could engage in things like this in a way that I wanted to. And so that's where I saw a lot of female and feminist blogs stepping in.
Great. Thanks. So now we'll go to Dora and pass this mic. And we need to actually pass this one down as
okay.
well.
It's
a little precarious.
When Jenna asked me to be part of this panel, she asked that we each choose one of the posts that we have or plan to post onto the blog and read it, and then use that as a jumping off point for a discussion.
By the way, I'm showing Dora's personal blog.
What did I write? Oh, okay.
Can I do that?
Yeah, sure.
The post that I'm going to share with you today was one of the first ones that I wrote back in January, and this was the first time that I had done any kind of writing for a public blog that wasn't explicitly for family and friends. So, bear with me. Interdependence Day. As a child, I was fascinated and repelled by the game Mousetrap. The outcome so dependent on every little piece working perfectly in and of itself and in concert with all the other little pieces. In my collegiate days, dependence used to be a dirty word. I hated relying on others, and delegation was as painful as a root canal. If I had to work on a group project, I always took the assignment that required the least amount of collaboration. Some of my favorite words included autonomy, independence, self-sufficiency, and individualism. However, I've done a lot in the intervening decade, and the shift that seems so sharp in comparison has been gradual in retrospect. As I've struggled with illness, rejoiced in health, furthered my career, developed talents, traveled the world, struggled with loneliness, deepened friendships, endured singles ward, returned to family wards, and come to grip with gray religious areas, I've come to see each day as a celebration of interdependence. Simply put, I've come to realize that interconnectedness is an essential part of life. Perhaps the easiest way to illustrate this is by relating it to my career. I work as a registered nurse within the specialty of pediatric intensive care. That's right. I save children's lives. And if it sounds like bragging, well, it is. I am the face that the patients and the family see. The one who offers comfort and relief, the one who does the assessments and treatments, the one who gives all the medications and draws the blood, the one who's most readily available to answer questions, the one who advocates for them and through whom they interface with the rest of the hospital. However, I cannot do this alone. I rely on the strength of 100 other people within my unit and the hospital at large. I rely on my fellow nurses to give me auxiliary support, whether my patient is crashing or just need a hand with a tricky procedure. I rely on doctors of innumerable specialties to diagnose and prescribe treatments. I rely on the housekeeping staff to keep the unit clean and functional. Respiratory, occupational, speech, physical, and play therapists, social workers, dietitians, secretaries, insurance billers, fundraisers, hospital administrators, translators, security guards, researchers, etc., etc. I need them all, and they need me. Paradoxically, this interconnectedness requires more from me than just self-sufficiency. It requires that I know myself implicitly, my limitations and strengths, and that I turn the former into the latter, and that I give generously of my dower. Our individual responsibility for humanity is awesome. So I'm taking more responsibility little by little. I was just called, well, actually I petitioned for it, but let's not split hairs, as Relief Society pianist. This means that I actually have to attend Relief Society. And as the weeks go by, I have found that I need these women around me. Feminist, traditionalists, young, old, singletons, married, childless women, mothers, women who have been divorced, stay-at-home moms, career moms, even the crazy woman who wears her SAG pin every week. They enrich my life, and this coming from a woman who couldn't stand home enrichment. Last week I was set apart, well, the other week I was set apart by a member of the bishopric who I've never conversed with and who barely knows my name. And yet, as he set me apart with phrases that he no doubt uses in a variety of settings apart, I was incredibly moved. I was blessed with the ability and the responsibility to develop my talents and that the sisters would be strengthened and draw closer to God through my efforts. On the surface, it seems so pat and prosaic, but it struck a chord that continues to resound. So yes, I am part of a complicated mechanism, not to trap souls, but to vault them to their highest potential. I may not perform my part perfectly at all times, but with our combined efforts, we will accomplish marvelous things. And I just like to just include my personal blog. It was originally started as in response to my mother, who claims that I never call her enough to update her on my life. And the fact that I hate talking on the phone just doesn't seem to enter into her mind at all. But this was a way that I could very easily communicate with friends and family who may live close or very far away or in other nations what's going on in my life. And we can carry on a dialogue through comments or emails. And so that was how I started blogging, and was very honored and petrified to be asked to participate on the Exponent 2 blog. But I do think it's a good way to, it's a forum that we can use to discuss issues that that we can't or that really don't have a place within our formal church meetings. And for which I'm very grateful. And that's, I'll stop right there.
Okay, well let's pause for just a moment and open it up to, who wants to ask Sandra a question? Oh, sorry, her other real name is Sandra, if we call her Dora on the blog. I should explain that. So, all right. And I'm, ask your question, I'll restate it for the mic.
Right.
Okay, so to restate, and let me know if I get it wrong, the audience member asked about Sandra's assertion that blogging gives her space to discuss things that she doesn't have space to discuss inside the formal institution of the church. Am I on the right track? So we'll pass the mic to Sandra.
I haven't come to a clear-cut answer on that yet. On the one hand, I feel that there are issues that are very, that affect my faith and that I think that are very important to discuss, that kind of fall in kind of a gray religious area. And on one hand, I'm kind of sad to not be able to discuss that in a formal setting. On the other hand, I found that discussions where I'm not afraid to speak my mind, that while I don't feel that it's that I can discuss them in certain formal areas, I found a community of people that I can discuss this with that's removed from the formal institutional meetings that we have at church.
So does that separation sadden you? I guess that's what, at the root of my...
At some point it does, but in other ways it's extremely liberating.
Okay.
So it's...
Could you say, tell me about the liberating part.
Well, because I've found this other community that is comprised of you know, some faithful, some struggling saints. That doesn't have to report to the bishop or to the Relief Society president or to, you know, those who don't know me very well, but because of reports of my doubts and my strengths could it's difficult for me to articulate, but I feel that I can discuss this in a place that's confidential, that I'm not going to be punished or censored in a way that I feel I could be in a setting where people, where I feel that people would disagree vehemently with me, instead of allowing me to come to terms with my my issues on my own time.
Correlation. Well, I mean, actually, it happened before that. There was a great history of women's publications and women speaking for themselves early in the church, like in the late 1800s to the early 20th century. That's when the Women's Exponent was in full blast, and this was a newspaper that women of the church subscribed to, and in which Relief Society presidents and whoever and other people who are interested in writing could write their opinions about anything. And talk to their fellow Mormon sisters. There was also the Young Women's Journal, right? Was that the name of it?
Right. I think that was later, though.
Yeah, maybe a little bit later, but also that had some kind of feminist forthright articles. There was the Relief Society magazine, and that lasted until about 1960, if I'm correct. And that was the last of our women-run publications. It ended in 1960 with Correlation, when they decided that no longer would women have their own publication. Instead, there would be something called The Ensign, which was supposed to be a family magazine for both men and women. But, I mean, my problem with The Ensign is that 80% of the articles are written by men, and it's heavily geared towards general authority articles. So it has a very, I feel like, a very male-dominated voice. And now women don't have any kind of magazine. The blog or the publication?
The blog.
No, I think it seems as if the authorities have been pretty hands off with blogs. I mean, I think because it's pretty ephemeral, like it's up for a day and then it kind of disappears into the archives. And I mean, the church would have to have so many people reading so many blogs to like catch people for saying things that are unorthodox. And I don't even think they want to go there. And they haven't gone there. And they could have. In our general conferences where our apostles get up and talk, they have ample opportunity to discourage us away from forums like this. And from what I know, they have not taken that opportunity yet. I think because also it's hard to even define, you know, what's a blog, what's a Mormon blog, what would be considered too critical. It would just be such a gray thing that they seem to be sort of hands-off right now, which is good stuff.
I think there is a sense of wariness, though, in the blogging community that maybe sort of this is a sort of honeymoon period or something, that at some point there will be a criticism or some kind of repression. My understanding, and I know there are more experienced bloggers in this audience, my understanding is that no one has received censure for a blog anything that they've written on a blog.
Is that right, Dave?
You're going to correct me. Okay, I think we're okay with that. I'm going to just say that. If I'm wrong, come and find me later and tell me I'm wrong.
This is kind of feeble.
There are people who've been criticized or who have had disciplinary action based on websites, and that's a sort of different genre. And we could talk about that, but I want to limit this to blogging right now.
In terms of official church, I believe that as long as you don't attempt to speak on behalf of the church, that really, in almost nearly any forum, people have been allowed. It's when you say,
I would actually, that's on tape. But okay, the comment was that maybe if you don't say they're going to speak on behalf of the church, there's a safe space. I think that's really contested. That's a dangerous claim to make, and I think there's people who, I'm not saying you're dangerous, but I'm saying that there's people who would contest that, if you know what I'm saying. So, but I think there is a sense of that. For another thing is, how would they figure out who is blogging and track people down? It's an anonymous, or like Carolyn was saying, it's a very ephemeral space. But I think as we go through and each person talks, you'll see that this space is something that's kind of exciting. It's particularly exciting for women, and I'm going to deal with more with this when I talk a little bit later. But it's an incredibly public space, but it's also ironically incredibly private. Like, you can talk about very private things, and the irony of this public-private divide and the way that blogs kind of straddle both of those, I think, make it a really interesting media. And so I'm excited to have the rest of our panelists talk about what they're going to end. Although, did we have one more question? Okay, we'll take one more question then.
I don't want to dominate, but mm-hmm.
Sure.
As someone who is outside of the church and going back to what you were saying, are they anonymous or do people know that you're...
Yeah. People know who we are, yeah.
And so I do feel the sadness.
Yeah.
Okay, so the statement that was made from the audience member was a sort of feeling of sadness that I'm not going to say this as eloquently as you did, but a feeling of sadness that maybe women or Mormons have to resort to a form like this to express themselves, and they don't feel the space to be able to do that within the church or the church institutions and programs.
And there's the fear, too.
And that there's an element of fear about truly expressing yourself within the church institution, but yet there is this space on the blogs where people can talk about things they can't talk about church. But that's just sad that it has to be that way. And I agree with you, but I'm also really excited that there is this space. I think I'll pass to Caroline.
Okay.
She'll talk more.
Yeah. Well, no, I absolutely agree with you. It's very sad to me as well. But to give you some background of where this fear is coming from, I mean, I think a lot of it for us women right now stems from what happened in the early 90s, which was when a bunch of female, like, feminist intellectual type people got excommunicated because they were very outspoken. And I believe this is a case where a woman, like women, would say, I believe I have the priesthood. So correct me if I'm wrong, people, but even just by saying, I personally believe I, as a woman, have the priesthood, they would get in trouble, and disciplinary boards and excommunication would sometimes result. So because of the spate in the early 90s, women, and there were things about praying to Heavenly Mother, and it just became like you became heretical if you went in these directions, and they got excommunicated. And so because of this, I think there is a lot of fear amongst women, particularly about feminist Mormon issues.
Okay. Actually, do you mind holding your question for a minute? Okay, let's go ahead and pass the microphone's down to Brooke Will, who's going to read to us, and I'll pull up her blog behind her. Behind us here.
Okay. My real name is Brooke Williams, so my alias is not that tricky. I actually have a poetry blog, and then more recently I started a... that one. That's good. I also started one that's more journal-like, where I kind of talk about my thoughts in prose. And what was the word you used for that?
Solo blog?
No, to have, like, poly...
Polyblogamous.
Polyblogamous. I thought that was so funny. I'm polyblogamous. One of the reasons that I really like blogging is because, well, partly, I'm really big on archiving. I'm like events and feelings, recording things, and this is just another venue for me to pursue those compulsions. It's also kind of... isn't it every amateur writer's dream to have their writing up where people can read it? It's really cool, I think, how there's potential for constant dialoguing. So there is this immediacy of access to these writings, you can just log on to the internet and it's there. That's also part of the danger of it, I think, that it's so easy to put something up there, and if you're not, you know, being thoughtful or careful about what you're saying, you can, you know, there's this potential very diverse audience. And, you know, on the other hand, though, I don't think that many people read blogs unless they know about them, right? So not very many people know about my blog. So I do have an audience in mind, but at the same time, it really is out there for everyone. So I am kind of careful. But I also really enjoy a lot of blogs that are very, I don't know, more honest and candid about things. Like Jana introduced me to the Deuce blog, which is hilarious, but also very irreverent, and I know she offends a lot of people, gets a lot of hate mail, so there's always a risk there, I guess. The reason I chose to have two blogs, well, I didn't really think about it that hard, but I just wanted to be able to have the separation, I guess, of my poetry and my prose. It's kind of a right brain, left brain thing, maybe. I don't know. But it feels, I mean, I think there's also something really nice about blogs like Jana's, where the entries are they're varied. There's recipes sometimes and photos sometimes, and it makes it more fun to look at, I think. But this is what works for me. I'll just read, maybe you could find, if you go back to previous posts, back pretty far to, on this one. The one called Refrigerator Noise. I'll read this poem. It's called Freedom and the Nighttime Refrigerator Noise. It grows quite rowdy until I am awake, afraid the neighbors will feel it. Like a giant, dark drumroll, but stark. Is it my comet or yours sounding those alarms across an everlasting, dividing highway? I speak only for myself when I say I need a cleaner, lighter, brighter, white noise to sleep by. And this is just one of my random poems. There's another one on the X blog that I'll share. Writing your identity. Yeah. So this post, I really was thinking about, because I hadn't really delved into writing about my Mormonness in my poetry, and I was thinking about doing it. And this poem is probably the closest thing I've done to that so far, but it's still pretty disguised, I think. This one I wrote about the Holy Ghost. It's called The Big Calm. It's like having the privilege of catching the bird that sits in my artificial tree outside the glass door. This is the one that's been making all those deep-throated, light-noted chortles at 3 a.m. when I wake and usually go right back to sleep. And having caught him with my eye through the glass, I see his effort put into sound. Much more muscle movement and strain, proportionately and passionately, than an opera singer puts into her aria. Shaking his entire tiny frame, and his notes no longer feel the same. This is the perception of something still small. I know truth, and I go back to sleep. And a bird, real this time, knocks on the glass door. I'll end there.
Okay, so questions for Brooke. How should we find you?
The comment was that when you're posting your poems on a blog, they're not. Like, how does a publisher find you, like Signature Books? Well, I haven't abandoned the idea of submitting regularly either, so this is just kind of for me. I think my poetry blog is more of a forum for people to give me feedback, which no one really does. I don't know, it's kind of hard because I don't know if the people that know about it know how to respond critically to poetry in general, but I think it's potentially a really great way to sort of have a writing group, like to be able to post poems and comment about them, give feedback, but I definitely plan on submitting in hard copy to magazines.
I guess it's a follow-up question that kind of goes to the issue.
The question was, how do we feel about the anonymity of the blog? Because his example was if Susan B. Anthony had published anonymously or on a blog type format, where would we be now? So,
okay, I'm a historian. I didn't reveal that earlier, but there is a very rich tradition of women publishing under pseudonyms or anonymously. So I don't see us necessarily deviating from a tradition that stems from 19th century and way much earlier than that in a lot of ways. And I think that has to do maybe somewhat with women trying to find a space where they can express themselves. Now, I don't think that necessarily addresses your larger issue, which the comment from the audience addressed Margaret Toscano, who wasn't afraid to publish. Okay, so talking about Mormon feminists who have published under their own name, the ramifications that they've experienced, but also the power that comes from making those claims in public and putting your name behind it, and by putting it on the internet and maybe sort of being anonymous, does that weaken what we're doing? Does that make us less, I can't think of the word, but less brave? Maybe we have less courage. We're using pseudonyms. And I don't know that I can give a definitive answer to that, except that what we're doing is so, and maybe this is again something that women tend to do. I wish I could speak from an academic perspective, but we're almost speaking just from personal experience and not making huge claims in what we're doing. And I think that's sort of a, women tend to do that, and women have historically done that, just told the stories of their lives rather than saying, this is something that the whole church should do, or making some huge claim about Mormon history or about the priesthood and that kind of thing. And so maybe there's sort of a space here for us to make these claims and not be trying to have a huge impact. And not to say that maybe in making those claims and creating a community of women who want to talk about these issues, that maybe at some point we won't have a huge impact. But I think we're starting small and just talking very personally right now in what we're doing. But let me pass the microphone down for other comments. Anyone else want to comment?
Really briefly. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I put a lot of thought into whether I would use a pseudonym or my name. And I chose to use my name, my first name. And as we said before, it's pretty easy to figure out who we are because we have our location. We're in Irvine. I mean,
photos.
We have photos. It's very easy. If someone wants to find us, they're going to find us. And I did think about using a pseudonym to give me even more protection so that I could be even edgier than I am currently. And actually, I'm not very edgy on my Exponent 2 blog because I'm responsible to a larger organization. I'm representing the Exponent 2, so I can't say everything I want to say. But on my solo blog, Mad Woman, you know, I did think about having, you know, keeping a pseudonym. But I decided against it because I want to be responsible. I want to be absolutely responsible for what I say. And I was afraid, you know, if to use a totally different pseudonym that was in no way connected to myself, I don't know, I just felt like there would be a temptation to be even more extreme or more provocative than I really was. And I feel like by keeping my own name and to some extent my own identity, I would just have to be a little bit more responsible. So that's why I chose to keep my first name.
Okay, so our commenter was saying that it's a little bit more understandable how women can be placed in a situation of danger through cyberstalking. It's so easy to find people online, just type in their name on Google and you can find out a lot of information about people that they may or may not want to have dispersed. I will answer that question that...
You've also had a personal experience with that one, right?
Yeah. I will say that when I started my personal blog, I only gave out the address to, like, very few friends and family. And I'm involved in an LDS, like, internet community. And, you know, a friend of mine said, you know, hey, you know, let's keep up with each other. You know, anyone who wants to, you can post your... you know, post your, you know, blog site, and that way we can all keep up on each other. And I specifically emailed him my blog, not on the list, but on a private email, and later found out that he had blog-rolled me, which is to, like, to put a link to my blog on his blog, so that everyone that he knows, which is a very large community, suddenly has access to my personal blog, and found out that someone that I was corresponding with, you know, had asked me about my blog, and I'm like, well, you know, maybe when we get to know each other better, I'll tell you where to find me. And, you know, he did tons of searches on the internet and couldn't find me because my name is very common, but then found my friend's blog and was able to find my blog, and it was a moment of like, oh, I'm writing about very personal things, and he has this, you know, aside from, like, you know, a stranger finding my blog and not knowing the more personal details of my life that I choose not to write about, he knows all this in addition to what we've already discussed. So that was kind of bizarre. But also, on my personal blog, I also talk a lot about my work because it's an integral part of my life. And with patient confidentiality, and there's a lot that I choose not to reveal on my blog, but I wouldn't want that information to negatively affect the hospital that I work for or the patients that I take care of. So that's one reason. And then as a form of responding to, like, taking responsibility for what I blog, I do have, you know, friends and family that read both my own personal blog and what I post on the Exponent. So I do feel, you know, a certain requirement to be, you know, to not be more, you know, inflammatory than I would be in person with someone that I'm meeting face to face. But maybe it's just the last vestige of trying to maintain some kind of protection against people who might be hostile towards me.
Honestly, I want to change the topic. Because I'm really interested in the topic of getting in trouble at church. Because I've already been talked to by a state president before. I'm a seminary teacher, which you might imagine is a huge risk if you open your mouth. But actually, what got me in trouble was the comment that I made in Gospel Doctrine. Not, although my seminary kids have called it, their parents, anyway. So, not just the you know, women in the church only, you know, guys can get themselves in trouble too. So, my question is, when I said earlier about being the official word of the church, when you say or present yourself in a fashion in which, to me, that includes sacrament talks would be considered as coming from, at least to the ward, from the official member of the church. But I've had very incredible conversations with institute directors, with bishops, about subjects that if I were to talk about them in sacrament meeting and talk would get me in trouble. But so, is... because your comment was, oh no, you get in trouble even if you don't say that it's official. Should we, one, what would our church look like if we had a culture where all this stuff, like, all this came up in Gospel Doctrine, it came up in priesthood, it came up in Relief Society. Would that make us as accessible to so many people as we are? We're becoming a worldwide church where the United States membership is lower than membership outside the church. If we start to talk about these types of gritty and edgy issues, and they come up more and more, are we a different kind of church to the world?
Okay, we just had a very long question from someone in the audience, and I don't think I can fully represent everything that you said in your comment/question, but okay, you talked about working for CES and having like things that you had said being questioned, and you're kind of exploring the idea of what can you say and not say, thinking about are there some things we shouldn't talk about at church, some things that are inappropriate to talk about, because then what would happen if we were talking about everything at church, versus are there some things that are better kept from a less official space?
Right.
Okay. So, first of all, I've been a seminary teacher, and I don't think getting called in for anything as a seminary teacher is very remarkable. I think I got called in for the bumper stickers I had on my car. So, I mean, it's not... Okay, I mean, I'm being very facetious, but I
You did, right?
I did, okay. So I'm not even going to really go there probably with this comment, but except that I think a part of me would love to have really juicy discussions at church. I think a lot of it has to do with time. You can't get into a really well-developed conversation. I blog every day. Well, okay, weekends, sometimes I take days off or I get busy. The Exponent, we blog almost every day. It gives us a chance to cover a huge range of topics that there's no way we could cover at church. We have such a limited time, and nobody wants to stay at church any longer than they have to. Okay, right? No one's saying, yeah, I wish it was 5 hours long. So that's not to say, though, that I don't wish that there was maybe more dynamic and interesting conversation at church. So I'm not going to, I'm not going to say that it wouldn't be fun if people couldn't maybe have some more of these kinds of conversations at church either. So I don't know about the fear of censure. I think, I honestly don't even worry about it anymore. So I don't know if anyone else. I worry about, I'm kind of careful when I blog not to say anything bad about people because I don't want them to come across it and feel bad, or I say it in a very veiled way. I'm kind of careful what I say because my mom reads my blog, so I'm kind of thinking, what is she going to think of me? But anyways, let me segue into, I'll talk a little bit now. Okay, I wanted to, again, I alluded to this earlier, talk about why I blog. And the sort of paradox of blogging being so public yet so private, a lot of times bloggers share very intimate things about themselves in an idea that this is a very, I don't know how to describe it, but you feel like you're not talking to anyone, you're telling your secrets, you're whispering, but yet it's all there for anyone to find. And why, I just think it's so interesting to be a part of this space. So, and at the same time, I feel incredibly close to some people that I've met on blogs. I've never seen a photograph of these people. I would not recognize them if they walked down the street. But yet, I follow their blogs daily. They follow mine. We comment on each other. We have a certain relationship built just on blogging. Very strange. And maybe this goes back to what I was saying before. We can have the type of discussions on blogs that we can't have in relief society. And there's all kinds of reasons why that is. And I think some of it is that a lot of us just have a certain public face, and we don't kind of reveal the inner self behind that public face. Okay, one of the reasons I first started blogging was because I had a desire to integrate different parts of my life into one whole. I'm an academic, I'm a mother, I'm Mormon, I'm a lot of other things, and I thought I wanted to try and not fragment myself so much. I wanted to be able to have a space where I could talk about all those different things in one place. And so my blog has sort of done that for me. It's been a place I could bring all these facets of myself together. And I think some people reading my blog are a little surprised because they don't know those other parts of my life. And it gives me an opportunity to share those with people. What else? The other thing I've talked about on my blog sometimes is blogging makes you very vulnerable because you are sharing really private feelings sometimes, and you can get hate mail. You can feel, I've called it feeling naked, and I've talked about being naked or feeling naked on my blog. It's not that I'm literally posting inappropriate pictures of myself, but it's that you're sort of exposing yourself to an audience you don't know who's going to read it and who's going to find it. At the same time, I feel like that's kind of a vulnerable feeling. I also feel it makes me feel empowered to be able to express myself
and not be afraid. Just put it out there. And if you don't like me, fine. If you do, comment and let's have a dialogue. But it's kind of comforting to me. I've also written personal essays and memoir kind of pieces where I've done that. And always I've had positive results. So blogging is a kind of experiment in that. Like I said, my mom reads my blog. All kinds of people read my blog. I've had...
Ex-boyfriends.
Well, this is the other funny thing. I have had so many old boyfriends Google me and find me through my blog, and they'll write me, and they'll say, and I actually met up with one. We had lunch not too long ago, and it was a very, very bizarre thing to have him reading my blog, and you know, after so many years. So it's, but yet I've had not just old boyfriends, but old high school friends too, girlfriends, whatever. But more than anything, I find new friends on my blog, so it's not just not the old. So I wanted to read a post to you that I wrote for Exponent that got a lot of comments. I think it's coming down here. And this is a topic that I think most people would not broach in a church setting. And I'm talking about periods on my blog. It's a very Mormon topic. And so I'm going, I'm not very Mormon, very female topic. That's what I meant. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit about this post. And some people, when I posted this, felt like it was completely inappropriate for me to be talking about in a public forum. And some of you might be feeling embarrassed right now. But so I thought I would read a little bit of this post and then read a few of the responses that I got. We were talking about the priesthood and how boys get it when they're 12 and girls don't have any similar ritual. We spoke of the way that boys emerge into a very visible role at that age and how significant it is for them to pass the sacrament each Sunday. We were bantering back and forth, and I'll add a comment. This was at a Sunstone session when my friend Holly replied, "You know where girls are at age 12. Unlike the boys who are getting public recognition for advancing to the priesthood, 12-year-old girls are locked in the bathroom with their Tampax." As I thought more about it, I realized that she was right. Girls at about age 12 have an important change in their lives, but it's a private, secret matter. For all the church's rhetoric about motherhood being equal to the priesthood, you would think there would be some sort of ritual or celebration to mark a girl's first period, the really big change in her life that allows the possibility of motherhood. My daughter's approaching her preteen years, and I've been thinking lately of how our family should mark her first period. I've heard of rituals like roses or parties. Though I want to do something special for her, I also don't want to invade her privacy. My first period came at a moment of huge change in my life. I was using the toilet in an airport bathroom when I discovered that I was bleeding. I was about to board a plane with my mom and sisters. We were in the process of moving from Colorado to California. The females were flying while my dad and brothers were driving the cars over. It turned out that both my mom and older sister were in the middle of their periods at that time, too. So we flew to California and then had 3 days in a hotel together while we waited for the guys. Mom and big sis gave me lots of advice and support. Gosh, that's redundant. I felt supported and loved. It was a very positive and memorable experience. I want to do something similar for my daughter when she begins her period, have some girl time with her, or have a special dinner party celebration, but I'm not at all sure what to do, and I feel like I need to have a plan, so I'm prepared when it happens. So I asked a few questions of the women reading the Exponent blog to share with me their experiences, like had their families done anything to mark their first periods, or did they have any good ideas for me, for my daughter? And I got a lot of comments on that, so I'm just going to jump. I just cut out a few of them here. So I don't have to scroll through everything. So one comment I received was, I'm going to take this off because you don't need to see that. Is it going to go away? Yeah. Oh, it's not going to go away. It's just up there now. It's not on my computer.
One more time.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go back. So one commenter said, "I think that just as the church shouldn't mark a boy's first wet dream, another biological reproductive function, it should not commemorate a girl's first period either. Boys all get celebrated for coming of age at 12, and girls should too, no matter where they are in their reproductive development. I do think that women should be more proactively prepared for their daughter's first period, though, and do something fun to celebrate and make sure that she has all the appropriate knowledge." Then she talks a little bit more about that. Another comment, "The church marking menstruation would do nothing but reinforce the completely illogical and unfortunate parallel of motherhood and the priesthood. For the church to mark menstruation in a way that in some way would be like them marking the boys passing through the physical sexual changes that mark puberty for them. The very thought of it is ridiculous. Why would it be any different for girls?" Another comment, "When I started my first period, I had what I remember as a positive experience. Let's see. She told her mother, she said, she's excited for me, and underneath my nervousness, I was excited too. She thoughtfully asked my permission if she could tell my close female relatives that were there with us that afternoon. We all wore red to some event that night, but the reason was our secret. That was about all the people I wanted to know. So anyways, I had all these women writing in. You can go back and read all the details. Am I embarrassing someone?
No.
Okay.
I'm always
going to
wonder why someone's wearing red.
Now you know. No, I'm wearing red. No, I'm just kidding. But this is the kind of thing I wanted. I purposely chose this post to read to you because it is kind of a freaky topic to be discussing in public. I mean, not something that we usually would bring up at church. And if we did, it would be maybe in Relief Society or Young Women's, and people might giggle about it and not talk in a really open way. We had people who commented in this post who talked about embarrassing accidents where they had blood on their clothing and what happened. We had people talking about horrible, what I consider horrible ways that their mothers reacted, almost with shaming them, with being really cruel. And we had talked about people who had very affirming family rituals. So I think, again, not something that we could necessarily discuss at church, but really important to me to have a community of women where I could ask this question and get everyone's responses. It gave me all kinds of wonderful ideas of things that I could do to work with my daughter. Okay, so let's go ahead and open up for a few more questions. Oh, we've got plenty of time. And then we're going to go to Caroline.
Ignorant, but I enjoy reading them.
The comment question was, did I know going into the Expo and 2 blog that posting my poems would not really elicit a huge response from people? People don't usually comment. I don't know if I knew that, but the kind of comments that I would appreciate are just any kind of response, because when I'm writing a poem, I want to know what the audience gets out of it, and if that's what I want them to get out of it. I think I try for the Exponent 2 blog to post poems that are more prose-like, that are not as cryptic, and that hopefully will produce a response, more of a response on that type of blog, that I can get more comments, but it hasn't really worked.
I will
keep doing it, because I think people do read them, they just don't know how to respond. So yeah, the comment was that sometimes when this reader has read my poetry, he's felt like I was articulating the inarticulable. And so in this kind of forum where there's a place to comment and the reader doesn't know, can't really articulate a comment, it's kind of a strange forum to have. And also that hearing me read my poems today made him think about putting a sound file up along with the poem. That's a good idea. I agree. I should do it. More questions on another topic?
Did you get those kind of emails too?
The question was, do the bloggers get comments and emails about being positively affected by something they've read from the blog? And the answer is a resounding yes. Every time I've looked at Feminist Mormon Housewives or some of the more edgy posts, I've seen comments and comments about that kind of thing, where someone's posted something that was daring and got that kind of response. Someone else want to?
I'll talk after you. Okay, I'm changing the visual. It keeps me going up here. But just to respond, a recent example,
And this actually fits in with the fact that we're sitting at a Sunstone conference right now. I was recently added on as a perma blogger on the Sunstone blog and posted this post about Mormons and disability. And I have a disability. It's not something I've talked about so far in this panel, but that is something that I do blog about often and get really interesting responses to, because I think it's something, another topic that's not talked much about. It's a sort of thing that we don't want to articulate, especially to the person who has the disability. Like, some people might ask my husband or my kids questions about my disability, not ask me directly. Anyways, so I put this post up about Mormons and disability on Sunstone blog, and I had a couple of responses that I felt like were particularly thoughtful, and it made me grateful that I was willing to talk about disability, even though it's maybe a little bit of a taboo subject, and particularly talking about my own disability on a blog, because I think that it's something that people who are disabled want to have a forum to discuss. So that's a recent sort of success story. And on my own blog, when I have shared personal stories about my disability or challenges that I have in my own life about my disability, I've had some really interesting feedback from people about doing that. So, okay, Sandra wanted to make a comment.
Well, I did a post a couple weeks ago, and it was in response to something I had read on Times and Seasons, which seems like a huge blog. But Nate Oman had talked about the purpose of the BYU dress code, is it, to provide a harmless way for college students to rebel, and. That, and in conjunction with a post that Deborah, who is also one of our bloggers on Exponent 2 blog, posted me to, it helped me write a piece that I'd been contemplating for a while about my own kind of need to have a little bit of a rebellious side. And I wrote it, and it was extremely cathartic for me to feel like, to understand that, you know what, I have this need, and what do I want to, now that I'm recognizing it, what do I want to do about it? And after making this post, I had several people who either, posted comments under that post or emailed me directly and said, I'm so glad that you wrote that. Thank you. I've been feeling this way. And kind of shared their own stories about how the tension between, being fully invested in the church and, finding times where they need space. And that was quite wonderful for me, because just to know that there are others who share, I think that's part of blogging, is to find others who share your same experiences and to, have a bit of external validation. Obviously, that's not where we want to find, our own self-worth, but to know that there are others who are dealing with the same issues and to find some commonality and a place to discuss them. Of course, I did have one woman who say, how sad that you're, that you just have this, really aberrant need, for this kind of weird rebellion, but, that's also part of a discussion, hopefully.
She was really rude. I would just troll the person that commented on, because unfortunately, one of the side effects of having a blog is you get trolls who don't want to have a meaningful conversation. They just want to say mean things and are quite cruel, and then they, Anyway, I'm going to move on. I'm going to talk, Sandra just mentioned the idea of community with blogging, and that's what I want to talk about. I think one of the most interesting questions about Mormon women blogging is why we do it. And we have our different reasons. So for some people here, it might be about personal artistic expression or reflection. For me, why do I blog? It's about community, which is what Sandra just mentioned. It's about a forum to raise issues. I blog to not feel alone. Church is really hard for me sometimes. Black and white statements, pat simplistic answers, choruses of how wonderful the church is, all of these serve to make me feel pretty alienated sometimes, because I just don't live in that world. And the church is great in a lot of ways, and I strongly self-identify as a Mormon woman, but I desperately need to have a place where I can also talk about the problems and the issues that I confront, particularly as a Mormon woman.
As we all know, Relief Society and Sunday School are not forums where this can easily be done. So I was thrilled when I found the female blogger knackle a year ago or so, because that's where I found the nuances I needed, that's where I found the conversations I craved, and that's where I found the honesty about struggles that I personally identified with. I wanted to read a bit of a post that first converted me to blogging on Feminist Mormon Housewives. I found it through Feminist Mormon Housewives was my gateway into the female blogger knackle. This post, which I found about a year ago, it satisfied my needs in a way that no Relief Society lesson ever had before, and it was called Proclamation Confession, and it was written by Lisa, who is the founder of Feminist Mormon Housewives. She's a mom, stay-at-home mom, three young kids, a faithful Mormon, but as you'll see, a woman who is willing to express divergent opinions. So she starts out, and I was riveted by someone being so honest and so open about their feelings. She says, what do I despise about the proclamation? Oh, how do I hate thee? Let me count the ways. Let's start with the whole preside thing. Preside? Nope, I don't think so. I'm not even interested in debating this because it'll just make me insane, and I'm already crazy enough. That's enough, really. I don't need more reasons. The preside bit alone is enough. I didn't come to the decision to hate it easily, by the way, and I do believe this is the first time I've expressed my feelings. But I cringed the first time I heard it, even before I took on the feminist mantle, and I haven't stopped cringing since. And now that I consider myself a full-fledged, fire-breathing feminist with an agenda, I've given myself permission to hate it. It's kind of freeing, actually, to admit that the preside crap is pure, stinky, yucky ugliness. I like to think that if I'd been old enough to hate the black priesthood ban with equal veracity, that I would have done so. And knowing myself, I think that's a distinct possibility. I certainly hate it that much now. Also a bunch of pure, stinky, yucky ugliness. Come on, people. Did any of you read that preside thing and not cringe? In your gut, admit it. You felt it. That clenching up of the stomach muscles. The tightening of the skin at the back of your neck. Perhaps a little tingling along the scalp. Yep, I thought so. And you know what I hate most of all? The thought of all you priesthood-holding men reading this right now, most of you excellent and thoughtful husbands and fathers who never in actual practice preside. You respect your wives, you trust and admire them, and are for all practical purposes equally yoked, but you sit here with smug assurance that you naturally come by that preside right by way of your Y chromosome. And I wonder, how would that be to just know your whole life that you're the one who gets to make the choices? You're the one who gets to preside. And how did you earn that privilege exactly? It's not earned then, it's granted by God. Oh, that's nice. So why do you get it? Because, I'll let you in on a little secret, fellas, you can preside and nurture and not one soul will fault you for it. But not me. Nope, I only get one half of that pie. And I'm ungrateful and misinformed and unfaithful and gasp, ambitious, because I don't like it. Because I don't believe it. Well, let me tell you what I think. It's crap. Amen. And that was her post on the proclamation. And this was so refreshing. And I hope this doesn't offend people out here. But, like, someone willing to be that out in the open was just a revelation to me. I'll skip. The comments ranged from extremely unkind to somewhat sympathetic. But I'll skip those. And I'll tell you why this was so meaningful to me. This was so liberating to read this. This was one of the first times I had visited Feminist Mormon Housewives, and I found this. Because, as I said before, she's a faithful, upstanding, dedicated Mormon woman. But she was willing to say that something from the prophet was crap. This was important to me because in some ways it validated a similar approach to some church things that I've taken personally. The realization that I can use this approach is probably one of the biggest insights of my adult life. I have come to realize that I don't need to swallow everything that I hear over the pulpit. I can pick and choose. I can pick the things that uplift and inspire, that affirm my worth and my divine potential, and I can reject the things that don't. And I can do this and still be an active Mormon. This has liberated me. When I was younger, because we have a living prophet speaking for God, I thought we had to accept it all, including some things that were horrendously painful, like the Hearken Covenant in the temple. I thought God really wanted it to be this way. Me, as what I considered from my interpretation of it, a second-class person who needed a man to mediate for me and to direct me. I tried and tried to reconcile that with my vision of a loving God, and I could not do it. But this approach, this new approach I found, of being able to write off certain ideas as cultural artifacts from men who were born in the Victorian age, has given me the freedom to, at this point, remain a Mormon. By rejecting the things in the church that I think are crap, I now have the freedom to embrace the things that I think are wonderful. So after reading Lisa's proclamation post, I really found a community at Feminist Mormon Housewives. I don't agree with all the posters. I agree with even fewer of the commenters, but I respect the way that Feminist Mormon Housewife women, the posters there, are pretty careful to affirm divergent opinions and approaches. To illustrate the openness of the divergent approaches that I found on Feminist Mormon Housewives, I thought I would read another exchange that I was particularly impressed by, probably because the opinions and approaches were pretty different, but I sympathized so much with both of them. About a month ago, Annie posted a question about, it's called God, that one, yeah. Annie posted a question about why, as self-proclaimed feminists, we're not doing more to refer to God the Mother as well as the Father in our talks, our comments at church, and so forth. Her point was that it would only be when we are just as comfortable to referring to God she as God he that women's status in the church would improve. Artemis, who was one of the regular contributors to Feminist Mormon Housewives, responded that she would be fearful of her membership if she took this approach, saying, "I'm not sure the cost of one's membership is worth the as yet uninhibited expression of devotion to Heavenly Mother. Why, you ask? Well, beyond the personal cost, which I could handle, if I decided that was the path I wanted and God wanted me to do, there's the cost to the other women and girls in the church. If I and my correct, as I believe, feminist principles leave the church, that's one less positive and relatively credible feminist voice and personality in the church. Young women couldn't look at me and think, she's a righteous sister, she's kept her name, maybe I can too. But if I stay, maybe then they can see me as being a positive leader in my ward. Maybe in little conversations with Relief Society women here and there, I can reinforce the idea that women and men are equal in all things, that women can speak up and lead and so forth. If I leave, I relinquish entirely my power and credibility to do that as one of the faithful within the fold. Sometimes, often, the more quiet and subtle influences for change are the more powerful ones." And so this is Artemis. I like her. I sympathize with her viewpoint. Annie, who originally wrote the post, responded and gave a totally different approach to this issue. She affirmed where Artemis was coming from, but said, "I guess all I can say is that for me, the constraints involved in moderation and tactful patient concern for how my every word may impact the group, it just feels too stifling for me. I don't have the energy to worry about when or how the church might open up to feminism. I don't want to care if the church is how I wish it were, or worry about incremental change of a communal nature. I want to live my beliefs. Let the church as a social body take the tortoise path that it must and abhor me. I don't care. I just choose to be me." And I love this exchange because you can see the breadth of feminism that I was finding on the web. Someone was choosing to tailor her ideas and her actions in order to work for a greater good. And then there was someone who couldn't deny who she is and was willing to risk alienation because she just couldn't deny who she was. These are conversations that I found in blogs. That there was just no chance I could find something like this in a sponsored church sector like Relief Society. And I needed this. Reading things like this, as I said before, it keeps me in the church because I know now that I'm not the only one who has issues and problems and sees places for improvement. I see other women who have similar concerns to mine, and I can bounce ideas off of them, and I can turn to them for advice and for community when my church community in real life just won't suffice. I was going to read a post about what I wrote on the Exponent 2 blog that illustrates the way I use my own posts to garner conversation and gather community, but in the interest of time, I'll just close there and open it up for more questions.
Sure.
Oh, gosh, restate. Do I see this as a forum that will open up the sponsored church sector, the institutional church, to like these kinds of ideas, like more edgy ideas?
Yeah, or like, yeah, that people would maybe feel more comfortable demonstrating leadership.
Yeah, I definitely hope that there is that kind of impact. I think blogs have a great potential for sort of opening up bridges and communities, because we're all in this blogger knackle, and we can all visit each other's blogs. So we have a lot of Orthodox mainstream Mormons that come in to Feminist Mormon Housewives. Feminist Mormon Housewives attracts a lot of people, and not a lot. I mean, there are a lot of feministy people that comment, but a lot of them are pretty mainstream. But there's dialogue being created, and there are friendships being created even across ideological spectrums. And I see that that communication, even between people who disagree, as something that can really open things up in even the institutional church. Because when these more Orthodox mainstream people who are getting into leadership positions, you know, see feminists or people who are a little bit more on the edge as human beings that they sympathize with, I think that there will then be more chances for them being sympathetic and passing sympathetic policies in the future.
I have a ton of comments for you, but there's a comment from a man in the audience who's curious about what he can do because he doesn't necessarily feel a part of the feminist blogernacle, or what effect can men have. And I'm going to point you to someone right there who is a male Mormon feminist, and there is a growing group of male Mormon feminists. And his site is mindonfire.com, and I recommend that you go and visit it, and you can become a little bit more involved in that community. He's looking actually at not just male Mormon feminists, but male feminists in general, which I think is an interesting dialogue, and it can have application to Mormon men who are interested in this as well. And there was a session at Sunstone last summer with a male Mormon feminist, so you might look to that for something new. Our blogs, even though they're very female, we have men who comment all the time, and we welcome men commenting as long as, I have to qualify that, not to hijack the conversation, because this is a primarily female space. And I think there have been issues at times where there has been a sort of accusation of hijacking a thread or something like that. I'm not going to even go there right now, because it gets sort of, people on the internet can sometimes get testy with each other, and you know how that goes. But I think read like Mormon Feminist Housewives, and read Exponent blog, and then talk about these issues with the women in your lives, and also make comments. Okay, so that's what I would recommend as the first step. And I think, you know, I suspect that most of the men in this audience are somewhat familiar with Mormon women in their blogs and probably have already done that. But I think that's a necessary first step. Okay.